it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate, and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Hi, I'm Wilfred Chan. I'm a writer of the Hong Kong diaspora. I was born in Hong Kong, currently based in New York City, and I'm a contributing writer for The Nation, and I'm also a member of Laosan, which is a transnational collective that is made up of Hong Kong leftists and our allies.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about the project. There's a Twitter account. We'll link to that in our show notes, but tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, Laosan formed as the protests were getting started last summer, and we realized that there was a lot that we needed to explain to both a Western audience in terms of the complexity in the history of Hong Kong and our political struggle, as well as to Hong Kongers about the need for a more transnational outlook and how to link up with movements overseas and not just lobby Western governments. We represent the left position in the Hong Kong movement, which is a minority position. It's important to remember that the Hong Kong movement is a really ideologically diverse movement. And there are a lot of debates happening within this movement, which are not always visible to outsiders. When you read about Hong Kong in Western media, you get a very one-sided narrative or a very simplistic, binaristic kind of story about Hong Kong's protests as about freedom, which is kind of the West, versus authoritarianism, which is China, right? And it's not that this isn't a theme that is dominant in the Hong Kong movement, but it's also about so much more than that. And if we get stuck in these binaries, we won't understand exactly what the struggle is about. So Laosan is a project to write, translate, organize on the ground, transnationally, cross borders, with other movements, with other writers, creators, everywhere, to look for these more complex stories and to show why taking Hong Kong as a starting point for our struggle means more than what you can see in mainstream media.
Talk about the relationship between China and Hong Kong and how the struggle there has been informed by that relationship.
Hong Kongers are, for the most part, migrants from mainland China. I mean, my family on both sides comes from China, right? And it's important to understand that for much of Hong Kong's history, a lot of Hong Kongers didn't really think of Hong Kong as a place in of itself. It was a temporary sort of situation where trade was happening, where there were a lot of opportunities in terms of business. But people in Hong Kong have long identified with China, whatever that means. So from the beginning of British colonialism in the 1840s, right after the Opium War, Hong Kongers have been rising up against this British colonial government, and sometimes even trying to work with movements in China against this British colonial government. So the most dramatic example to me is the so-called leftist riots in 1966 to 1967 in Hong Kong, where you actually had Maoists across the border link up with labor struggles in Hong Kong. leading to one of Hong Kong's largest and most violent anti-colonial uprisings, which lasted nearly 2 years before the British occupiers cracked down, using actually a predecessor to the national security law that we now see in Hong Kong today. And at the same time, you have records, that show the CCP back then considered and then decided against trying to retake Hong Kong because it saw that having this city stay as this quasi-Western outlet for global trade and capital would be important to China in the future. And so when you had the reform and opening under Deng Xiaoping in 1978, Hong Kong was sort of tapped to play a leading role in this new market direction of the Chinese Communist Party. And so throughout the 80s, you had negotiations between Deng and Margaret Thatcher about what the future of Hong Kong would be, which was enshrined in the Sino-British Joint Declaration, which is sort of the agreement which sets forth what we now know as the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region. In other words, the post-handover, post-1997 Hong Kong. And so after this agreement between the UK and China, which, by the way, not a single Hong Konger was invited to, be a part of and negotiate, Hong Kongers sort of had this idea that the city would become this Hong Kongers had this idea that the city would play almost a leading role in the next chapter of Chinese modernity, which really seemed to be moving toward global capitalism. And so then you have all sorts of disorienting shifts in the CCP's own internal struggles about how closely to stick to, the Western model or try to create their own model. And with each of these shifts, you have extremely disorienting consequences for the people in Hong Kong. So the first big turning point was the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989, where a lot of Hong Kongers who maybe felt a bit of optimism about this coming handover looked at what the CCP was doing to people standing up peacefully, asking for democracy, and rightfully perceived that maybe Hong Kong people would be next. And then you have two decades of the CCP growing more friendly and more enmeshed with Western global capitalists. And then kind of another disorienting reversal with, Xi Jinping taking power in 2012. So at each of these junctures, Hong Kong people have had to reevaluate where they stand with regard to China and the CCP. And Hong Kong politics needs to be understood through this really complicated history. In terms of the political relationship between Hong Kong people and the leadership in Beijing, you can think of it as a theme of deferred and broken promises. So when the Sino-British Joint Declaration was signed between Deng Xiaoping and Margaret Thatcher, they agreed that Hong Kong would enjoy democracy. Universal suffrage was the term used to select the city's leader after 1997. And this was basically the understanding, even after what happened in Tiananmen Square, although it certainly was called into question. And after the handover, you have, many, many years and many good faith efforts by Hong Kongers to try to actualize this promise from Beijing. And you have a lot of half-hearted attempts by Beijing to, satisfy their own promise without actually giving Hong Kongers too much control. This kind of came to a head in 2014 when Beijing proposed a so-called, democratic electoral reform in which Hong Kongers would get to cast a vote for their own leader as long as Beijing essentially vetted the candidates. So Hong Kongers rightfully saw this as a sham, and they responded with the Umbrella Movement, which was a 79-day street occupation in front of Hong Kong's government headquarters to demand that this electoral reform process be restarted. You know, that this was not acceptable, that this did not fulfill Beijing's own promise of democratic elections in Hong Kong. But, you know, the Hong Kong government, backed by Beijing, dug its heels in. And after that, you had a couple years of increasing repression in more and more blatant ways. So you're talking about legislators getting arbitrarily disqualified by the Chinese Communist Party. You're talking about people getting spirited across the Hong Kong border for publishing books in Hong Kong that were critical or gossipy about the private lives of some of China's top leaders. You get a growing sense of doom in Hong Kong, especially with more and more activists getting jailed. And all of this pressure built up until 2019 when the chief executive of Hong Kong, Carrie Lam, tried to introduce the infamous extradition bill, which, you know, would have exposed Hong Kongers to the very opaque Chinese legal system. So this was kind of a final straw for Hong Kong people. And folks rebelled. You saw 1 and then 2 million people out of a population of less than 8 million people coming into the streets at one time. You know, weeks after weeks of peaceful protests, which resulted in nothing, and pretty soon escalations into more confrontational protests, which were met by increasing police violence from Carrie Lam and her cronies. So, you know, you had this situation where all of these years of kicking the can down the road of, you know, deferred promises of basically not trying to solve this problem of what is post-colonial Hong Kong going to look like. Resulted in this massive uprising, which now is being openly crushed by force, most vividly with the national security law, which was passed 2 weeks ago unilaterally by the Chinese Communist Party. This law essentially outlaws dissent in Hong Kong, and it means that just posting a meme on Facebook could land you in prison. It could mean that you don't have the right to a lawyer to defend you, you know, in these new special courts that are going to be set up. It could mean that you actually have to face trial in mainland China. I mean, the repression is accelerating at light speed at this point, and it's a very scary time for anyone who's in Hong Kong and anyone who cares about Hong Kong.
You mentioned the fear and this recurring theme of fighting the extradition bills. Why is that so important for people? What are they so afraid of? If you can just describe that fear and what rightfully they're afraid of.
So Hong Kongers cannot get Tiananmen Square out of their heads. You know, in 1989, Hong Kongers sent mutual aid to the protesters in Beijing. Some Hong Kongers flew to Beijing and were part of the movement. And when the tanks rolled in, many of the activists actually fled to Hong Kong. And so we have a long history of identifying with these social movements in mainland China. And, you know, we have this arrangement called One Country, Two Systems, where supposedly Hong Kong has a different set of laws, you know, control over its own affairs, and is basically autonomous in every respect other than, you know, it doesn't have its own military, and ultimately, you know, Beijing has the final say. But it's this very strange form of governance that is really the thing that stands between, you know, the arbitrary state violence of the Chinese Communist Party and, you know, Hong Kong people who have been very outspoken about things like human rights and democracy and, you know, these different values that they hold. So, it's really important for Hong Kong people to take these threats seriously. And the extradition bill really represented the final breach of this thin legal wall that separates Hong Kong from basically what happened to the students in Tiananmen Square. But, you know, it's not, of course, just about what happened in 1989, but really also about what's been happening to Hong Kong people. And, you know, in the years between 1997 and now, you've seen increasingly bold state violence in Hong Kong against peaceful protesters, against activists who are a little too outspoken, against academics, against book publishers. And, you know, it's really worrying for a place that has long prided itself for being, you know, a refuge for free expression. It's something that it's not just Hong Kongers who are protective of, but a lot of our allies are activists in mainland China who understand that Hong Kong needs to be defended, because without this, a lot of Chinese activists also don't have a place to go, right? They depend on help from Hong Kong to push labor struggles, to push feminist activism, to push, you know, LGBT kind of queer struggles in mainland China. And these are just some of the examples of what's lost now that you have this increased repression.
Let's talk a little bit about how the recent uprising kind of kicked off.
You know, Hong Kongers have not been known for rising up until recently. Even in 2014, when you had the 79-day street occupation, the umbrella movement, a lot of Hong Kongers were really taken by surprise at seeing their city transformed into this battleground. And what's actually been happening behind the scenes is a lot of really strategic and diligent organizing by Hong Kong social movement activists, you know, since the handover, even before the handover, to try to demonstrate that the state, meaning either the Hong Kong government or its backers in Beijing, really don't have the best interests of ordinary people in Hong Kong at heart. You know, one of the perennial issues in Hong Kong is housing prices. I think this is a really good way to get into just how this intersection between global capitalism and, you know, Hong Kong state violence works. In Hong Kong, the legislature is half elected by people. The other half is directly appointed by literal corporate interests. So you have different sectors like real estate, banking, tourism, who get to choose legislators to go into, you know, Hong Kong's version of parliament, which we call the Legislative Council, and cast votes and create legislation, right? So you have the chief executive, aptly named, who is the number one defender of this corporate establishment in Hong Kong. And, you know, she, Carrie Lam, is obviously not democratically elected. And together, this system keeps this oligarchy in place, right? So you have increasing housing prices, which are a result of the stranglehold of this real estate oligarchy that's working with, you know, the chief executive and, you know, the legislators that they themselves chose to basically collude with developers to drive up the prices, to win handsome profits for themselves at the cost of the livelihoods of everyday people. This is done at the bidding of Beijing, you know, which represents the corporate interests in this case. Beijing has untold, you know, billions of dollars in Hong Kong accounts, in Hong Kong real estate, because of China's capital controls. You know, Hong Kong is one of the prime outlets and inlets for, you know, capital, you know, going to the CCP. It requires this authoritarian government, right? And I'm talking about the people, the politicians in Hong Kong, to make sure that this system stays in place. So when we say we're fighting for a democracy, you know, people in the West might think of that as kind of quaint, like, oh, yeah, like democracy. Cool. I mean, you know, like when's the last time voting did anything for us? Right. But in Hong Kong, it's seen as the one thing that could actually challenge or begin to challenge, you know, this total domination, this hegemony by these moneyed interests, these capital interests in Hong Kong. So people choose this as their starting point. They say we have to win democratic elections so that we can finally have some kind of say over how resources get distributed in this city, how, you know, social policy gets made. The continued stonewalling by Beijing and by Hong Kong to deliver this promised universal suffrage to Hong Kong people has led people to become more and more frustrated, more and more disillusioned with the system until, you know, they rise up.
I'm just curious, like, do people in Hong Kong, especially young people that are involved in the protests, do they see this as a struggle against like two economic systems, or do they recognize that, you know, this is two flavors of kind of the same empire?
The protests are not articulated economically by a majority of the protesters. It's primarily a political, a politically articulated struggle for them. And, you know, it's not that people don't have an economic consciousness, but people have a consensus that the political victory needs to come before we can even talk about economics, right? As I just mentioned, the whole economic system, this oligarchy in Hong Kong, is constituted by this completely rigged electoral system that's designed to keep corporate interests in power. So we have to challenge that first, and that's kind of the consensus. That being said, I think that there's a lot of room, right, for Hong Kongers to develop an even stronger leftist analysis about the difference between these economic systems. I think part of the disadvantage of this model of movement is that because the political concerns are always seen to come first, there isn't a lot of sharp, you know, dialogue or discussion about the contradictions inherent to Hong Kong's economic model. But really, if you want to look at why Hong Kong is an unfree place in the first place, you have to understand the economics, right? You have to understand that Hong Kong's paradoxical governance, in which it seems much like a nation state in many respects, but is denied that autonomy, is precisely because of its usefulness to both Western and Chinese capital. They need Hong Kong as this extraterritorial exception that they can route their trade through, that they can use to get around, you know, these tariffs that Trump has been setting up, that they can, you know, store their capital. And this is the reason that Hong Kong exists, is to kind of be this in-between place. So if we don't critique this system of global capitalism, we're just going to be trading one kind of, you know, colonial or quasi-colonial rule for another. And so this is one of the top priorities of the Hong Kong left, is to have this conversation with Hong Kongers, right, about the fact that we can't just turn to the West. We can't just ask the United States to come in and you know, quote unquote, liberate Hong Kong. Because, in fact, the U.S.-led economic order is actually what's keeping Hong Kong in this state of perpetual unfreedom. And there's a lot of reasons why that consciousness hasn't been developed to the extent that we want it to be in Hong Kong, including just, you know, like in many places where you have failed or very distorted leftist revolutions. Hong Kongers don't have fond memories of what leftist politics look like, you know, in their daily lives. So many people have relatives who were killed or tortured during the Cultural Revolution. These are kind of very, it's right there. It's something that, you know, when you say the word left in Hong Kong, when you talk about socialism, much less communism, people have a different, image of what that means. And it's a personal, kind of feeling, right? So we have to try to, get past that too. We have to explain that, you know, the Chinese Communist Party is not communist. I mean, not since 1978, they haven't been a communist party. And, you know, regardless of what your views are on the terminology, I mean, it's very clear that they are leading a highly exploitative, model, economic model that's disenfranchising hundreds of millions of migrants, who are made to work in horrible conditions, and that Hong Kong's economic model is completely tied up in that too. So we really need to have that deeper discussion. And at the same time, we're trying to explain this to Western audiences who are also many coming to grips with this for the first time. Like, what? China isn't actually communist? Like, China is actually creating a more efficient version of the brutal kind of capitalism that is already destroying communities in the United States? What? Like, and so, you know, there's so many different enemies here. And that's one of the big challenges that we face.
Awesome. Well, that really leaves us into our next question. Communist Party leaders have alleged that the new national security laws are needed to push back, especially against foreign influence, which is something that is echoed from tankies. Tankies being kind of a poke at people that support authoritarian socialist or communist regimes. It's also like a reference either to Tiananmen Square with the tanks or the invasion of Hungary in 1956 by the Soviet Union. And this is something that kind of you'll see a lot of on social media whenever people quote on the left or autonomous anti-capitalists or anarchists or anti-state communists bring up support of the rebellion in Hong Kong. A lot of people that are tankies will respond that these protests are simply appendages of the CIA or backed by the U.S. or some people go even further and be like, oh, look, they have Pepe the Frog memes. This is alt-right. Or, hey, Ted Cruz went over there and he's down with it. You know, how can this be something that's cool?
Yep.
So let's kind of unpack that. Let's get into the reality of both just what the Communist Party is saying, that this is needed to stop foreign influence, and also kind of the alleging from tankies and other leftists, or if we want to call them that, that this is indeed kind of something that's coming from the United States, backed by the CIA, and basically the demonstrations and the revolt that's happening in Hong Kong is, quote, not real. It's all just manufactured.
Yep. Well, you know, it's a deliberate, total misunderstanding of what's happening in Hong Kong. And, what all these folks have in common, and I'm talking about the authorities in Beijing. I'm talking about tankies or these sort of pro-CCP Western leftists. And I'm also talking about, the Hong Kongers, the minority of Hong Kongers in the movement who are waving U.S. flags and kind of cheering on folks like Ted Cruz. And of course, I'm also talking about people like Ted Cruz, is that they want to see this struggle as a binary struggle, right? They want to see this as a very simplistic showdown between these two kind of civilizational powers, you know? And it's an appealing and simplistic narrative. When you have so much failure on every single level, right? You have failure at the level of global capital. You have failure at the state level. You have failure, of post-colonialism to really deliver a lot of these promises, in the wake of the Cold War. People are looking for answers. What nationalists want to do is basically posit that, only one side has the answers. That it's going to be a kind of, great power that once again comes and triumphs over the other great power and restores some kind of peace and coherence to the world. And we just know that that's not true. I mean, it's, a simplistic kind of enemy of a enemy is my friend logic, right? But in doing so, they deliberately ignore the way that the US and China actually work together to uphold not only this larger system of global capital that's extremely exploitative to untold numbers of people, but also this larger carceral system that enables that global capitalism, right? The system of policing, surveillance, mass incarceration, that's happening on just an incomprehensible scale in both the United States and China. And so to the folks who are making these sorts of arguments, right, all the way from tankies to Ted Cruz, these systems are okay as long as the side that they like is in charge of them, right? So tankies might say, you know, the Chinese model is actually way better than the U.S. model and that we should be like that. You know, Ted Cruz and people like, you know, Josh Hawley will say, well, yeah, you know, the U.S. is still the bastion of freedom. And, you know, we don't need to, we're all familiar with the rhetoric. And so these attacks have been very revealing because it means that our job as Hong Kong leftists, as internationalists, as people who are interested in a global vision of abolition, is that we have to fight on multiple fronts, right? This is not a binary struggle. Cold War logic isn't just scary in that we don't want to see, you know, a return of, you know, the sort of massive geopolitical struggles, but it's scary in the way that it erases the true nature of this struggle, and it discredits the people who are actually trying to articulate a way out for people, and not for for another nation state, not for another geopolitical power. So, you know, we have to reject that, and I think that taking Hong Kong as your starting point for your analysis means that you have to reject these things. If you go far enough, you know, you understand that. Hong Kong sits as this place that uniquely embodies all these elements of all these systems that are failing, right? Like liberal democracy, capitalism, finance, you know, these Western international institutions, Chinese authoritarianism, post-colonialism, all these things failing to deliver their promises with dramatic consequences. So for Hong Kong to get free means we need to find ways out of all of these things somehow at once. And there can't just be one enemy. And that's really the challenge and the difficult story that we have to keep telling and keep getting people to understand.
So let's talk about what role have tankies in the U.S. played in attacking the Hong Kong resistance, at least on social media and alternative media?
Well, as I said, their attacks are very revealing. They show that they have fundamentally a nationalist view of the world. You know, and I think it's sad that their imagination of what internationalism means, is really no more than, well, let's hope that another great power can somehow solve the problems of the U.S. that we can't solve on our own, right? And, I think it's a total, you know, it's so disappointing in the way that in looking around for international solidarity, they look at governments and not at people, right? There are so many people who come from different contexts, have different histories of struggle, who may not be thinking about the same things in terms of what the next step is in these movements needs to be, but, you know, are ready to learn from one another. And something that we keep saying to these attacks from, you know, Western leftists is, look, we're not trying to deny that there are right-wing sympathizers within the Hong Kong movement, right? We're not trying to deny that Ted Cruz and these different grifters have been very loud and have seized the mantle of somehow protecting Hong Kong. What we are trying to say is that we're fighting this on the ground, tooth and nail, that there are leftists who need help, and they're looking around and they don't see that there's support coming from, you know, the Western left. And so if we are concerned, as we say, about these reactionary right-wing elements within the Hong Kong movements, then help us organize against them, right? Help us work to, you know, eliminate this facile kind of U.S. worship that still exists in parts of the Hong Kong movement. Help us talk to them. Help us explain why this flag is actually not a symbol of freedom or democracy. Help Hong Kongers understand, you know, our history, where we're coming from, because that's exactly what we're trying to do. And, you know, it's funny because they never take us up on that. And it really goes to show that it's not really about you know, the character, the ideological character of the Hong Kong protesters for them. It's that we're opposing the country that they've placed their hopes on, right? The Chinese Communist Party. We're opposing and complicating this fantasy that they have, that, you know, this great power, the CCP, is somehow going to save the day. And so, you know, if they really were concerned about what's happening to Hong Kong people, if they really were concerned about, you know, the folks in mainland China who we work with, you know, who Hong Kongers continually support across the border in ways that, you know, aren't going to be obvious to someone who's reading English only and living in the West, then, you know, work with us. We're here. We're trying to articulate this struggle against immense odds. And, you know, I think it's just, it tells you what they're really about when they continually decline that offer. So look, you know, we're not here to say that the entire Hong Kong movement is leftist. We're not here to say that that we have, you know, perfect politics, that there aren't inconsistencies or contradictions that we're struggling through. We're trying to say that we all have these contradictions, right? That we're all trying to undo multiple systems. And we need, you know, material support, theoretical support, you know, discursive support, just, you know, that's what solidarity means. Not kind of, you know, role playing and kind of pretending that there's a leftist savior just over the horizon coming to, you know, fix the problems of the world for good. That's not true.
I will march down an empty street like a ship into the storm. No surrender, no retreat. I will tear down every wall just to keep you warm, just to bring you home. I will burn this city down for a diamond in the dust. I will keep you safe and sound when there's no one left to trust. Will you take can make our stand? If your world falls apart, I'd start a riot. If night falls in your heart, I'd light the fire. In the dark, when you sound the alarm, we'll find each other's arms free. I will wade through the fire and smoke like sunlight through the haze. I will fight till the flag waves white until my dying days. Through the bombs and blasts, we will take it back. If your world falls apart, I'd start a riot. In the dark, when you sound the alarm,
protests themselves have really been inspirational, I think, have kind of also signaled. I mean, they've gone on for so long. And I think that's one of the reasons that so many people have been inspired by them. If you could speak to this, just their longevity and just, you know, the fearlessness that people have had to go up against, you know, a highly militarized, you know, surveillance state. And, you know, also that has all this violence, behind it. I mean, obviously it's been an inspiration to people in the United States, and we've seen people kind of take tactics and ideas, from people in Hong Kong, for instance, you know, using, cones to put over tear gas and pour water on them and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think the, Hong Kong protests have a lot of lessons for, the Hong Kong protests have a lot of lessons for all of us. And it goes beyond tactics. It's, you know, the cones and the tear gas extinguishing, that's great. And it makes me happy to see the line of umbrellas popping up in Seattle and in New York, and kind of, we're adapting together, right? It kind of physically embodies, what, the beginnings of this transnational solidarity could look like. But I think that there are even more important lessons from what's happening in Hong Kong. And it has to do with the fact that Hong Kong, this is not a place that you would expect to see such a pitched showdown. Right. If you believed in what liberals were saying after the end of the Cold War, that history was over. Right. If you believed in what successive U.S. presidents have said about hope being around the corner, if you believe what, the Communist Party rhetoric says about the Chinese dream and these new eras of prosperity. You wouldn't think that 2 million Hong Kongers would feel the need to express themselves in such risky ways, right? These are Hong Kongers who live in a first world city, who enjoy some of the, best public transit everywhere, beautiful views, amazing food. You would think that you'd have it all. But I think the lesson here is that these ideas that we have about modernity, whether that's Western modernity, or, this kind of emergent Chinese modernity, are actually very, thin, and that they have not resolved the contradictions that were put forth, during the Cold War. And so now we're seeing this new Cold War, right? We can call it that now. It's no longer a theoretical idea. I mean, we're in it, which is, really, round two of trying to resolve this problem. As I said, Hong Kongers, face such immense odds in terms of being able to articulate a genuine kind of freedom, that we all need to kind of look at this and go, how could this happen, right? How could this place, that has so many aspects of what has been considered good, in both the West and the East, combined in one place, why would it still be going through such an awful existential crisis? Why would people here feel, still so bitter and so unhappy with the status quo? And when you take that question seriously, when you ask why students as young as 10 years old would go outside and fight with militarized cops, right? Because they think that is actually their best shot at having a say over their own future. I mean, that is bleak. That is a really bad sign for everyone, right? And so I think that Hong Kong, is both sort of like this echo of these unresolved Cold War conflicts and portending the beginning of the next one. So if we can look at the dynamics in not just the movement, but really the constitution of this thing, this city, this idea of Hong Kong, this thing called Hong Kong, and try to figure out its contradictions, its weak points, but also what it was trying to do. We might actually gain some kind of insight into where this is all headed. Where this we're all headed. regardless of where you live. So, you know, that's very high sounding, I know. But I think that if we're going to talk about the historical aspects of Hong Kong, you know, why this is such a interesting protest, if I can use that word, then we have to look at it from this angle.
Trump just issued a new executive order on Hong Kong. And you all wrote that the State Department has been, training the Hong Kong police force for many years. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious, you know, if you want to speak to where does kind of like the fiction of like the communist plot boogeyman kind of end and the reality of the real relationship between the United States and the Chinese Communist Party begin?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it bears repeating that the U.S. and China depend desperately upon each other to uphold this system of global capitalism, which is increasingly enriching a very small number of people on both sides, who are working with the highest levels of the state on both sides. So even as you have someone like Steve Bannon, you know, beating the drums for this new Cold War, for this new confrontation, a lot of people don't realize that in 2017, something like 2 weeks after he was let go, you know, from the Trump administration, whatever that means, he took a trip to Hong Kong and he gave a speech to a closed door conference room of investment bankers from China's largest state-owned bank, and basically, you know, talked about capitalism. I mean, what else would you be talking about, right? So the Hong Kong left was the only group of people that went out and actually protested this meeting. I was there. I was with you know, a small group of activists, socialists from Hong Kong, anarchists from Hong Kong, and we stood outside and basically held up signs that pointed to the fact that you know, Trump and Xi Jinping are two sides of the same coin, right? They're colluding with each other to uphold the system of unfreedom. After this meeting in Hong Kong, Bannon took a flight to Beijing, where he was actually personally invited by the man who is now the vice president of the China, you know, of the People's Republic of China, to talk about economic nationalism. Right, this is in 2017, and so, you know, these stories are actually everywhere. You just have to dig a little bit, but they're in the public, and there's so much, you know, there's just a wealth of evidence. That these ruling classes are intimately collaborating, and so, you know, so the question is what do we make of these kind of nationalist so the question, of course, is what do we make of this nationalist rhetoric that we see on both sides that often sounds like they're getting ready for war? I mean, look, we're not saying that that's not real. And we also know that if war were to break out, that Hong Kongers, you know, we would be among the very first to suffer. There's nothing in it for us to want a world like that. But we also have to read it against, you know, where the money's actually going, and try to evaluate to what extent these nationalist discourses are covers or distractions. Or different kinds of rhetoric to keep people believing in the idea of a binary struggle, you know, this geopolitical contest, while in fact global capital is consolidating its grip on power across borders every single day. You know, so the report that we just put out is, and it's actually not something that, you know, people can't just go and find from public information, but Trump's latest executive order on July 14th, that's yesterday, basically revealed a lot of the extent of how the U.S. government was collaborating with the Hong Kong government. And it revealed it because, you know, the executive order is basically Trump saying, okay, the U.S. is no longer going to treat Hong Kong with a policy that's different than the rest of mainland China, because the national security law in Hong Kong, you know, essentially makes Hong Kong the same as China, right? But, you know, in doing so, he had to enumerate exactly which policies were going to be drawn down, you know, which immigration laws were going to be revoked, which trade, you know, policies were going to end. And one of the things that, you know, was kind of buried halfway down there, but we spotted right away, was that the U.S. State Department will no longer provide training to the Hong Kong police force, you know, will take steps to end the provision of training to the Hong Kong police force. It's right there in Trump's executive statement, executive order. So, you know, we looked into this and it's in the open. The U.S. State Department has, through this agency that it calls the International Law Enforcement Academies, you know, has been training cops from Hong Kong, from Macau, from Thailand, from, you know, all sorts of Asian countries, including, it appears, China, in these sessions where they learn how to, do so-called anti-terror operations, do drug raids, do interrogations, investigations, you know, deal with like special hostile situations. And you have these photos of these rows and rows of Asian law enforcement officers sitting in these rooms listening to presentations by these white State Departments, or, you know, there's even U.S. Secret Service agents, there's DEA agents. I mean, you know, look, we talk all the time about how state violence is interlinked, and a globally articulated system, right? It constitutes itself across borders, that these states use other states as precedent and as cover and actually as material support for their own kind of state violence against their own citizens. We talk about this all the time, but you couldn't have a starker example than this, that the U.S. State Department has for many years been literally training the Hong Kong police force and working with them. And so, you know, I think that it also is a very neat response to the fiction, the conspiracy theories that are continually pushed by Hong Kong and Chinese authorities with no evidence that the State Department somehow trains millions of Hong Kong, you know, people to rise up and protest, when actually the U.S. government has been training the police force that is repressing these protesters. So, you know, it lays bare the hypocrisy of the national security law in Hong Kong and its pretext of fighting so-called foreign collusion. You know, it just reminds us that the struggle for police abolition needs to be global. You know, when we say abolish the police, we don't mean abolish the police here, but other countries' cops are good, right? We mean abolish the police. Abolish the police means abolish the police. So we need to think of, you know, what kind of international conditions would allow us to end all police states, end all these security states, end these so-called national security laws, which are not just happening in Hong Kong, but, you know, happening in so many different countries. You know, we're talking to folks in the Philippines every day who are so terrified of what's happening. Some of these folks are even, you know, Filipino Hong Kongers who face it on multiple fronts. So, I mean, this is accelerating. And, you know, we're uncovering stories like this, but we need to really develop our analysis to account for the way state violence works across borders.
The national security law has now been passed. So I think a big question we've got to ask is, what does this mean? Are they going to start kicking down doors? Are we already starting to see how this new reality is going to play out? Are they going to wait until there's another kind of wave of uprisings? And also, how are people going to respond to this?
Yeah, I mean, there have been protests already. You know, the very day after it was passed, thousands of Hong Kongers took to the streets. You know, people did get arrested and charged under this new national security law. We don't know exactly how those cases are going to play out yet. We're all, you know, waiting and watching with a lot of grief and a lot of nervousness. But this is the culmination of a tendency that we've always known was there, right? There was never anything theoretically stopping the state from from getting to this level. And so it's just become real now. And, you know, if you are an anarchist, if you are an anti-state leftist, you've basically had this baked into your assumptions, I think, in your organizing and in your work from day one, right? The state is never your friend. And so for Hong Kongers now, you know, we have to keep each other safe. We keep us safe. We have to develop even more sophisticated forms of mutual aid, evading censorship and surveillance. You see a struggle right now with a lot of Western and even, you know, Chinese tech companies trying to figure out how exactly to articulate their relationship with users in Hong Kong. And, you know, that's something that we need to keep a close eye on, how exactly these similarly unaccountable tech platforms are trying to negotiate this new reality, and what kind of hidden forms of violence they're also going to give tacit cover to or actually enact. It's bleak, but what choice do we have, right? We can't completely give in and self-censor, because then we lose, right? We can't just stop doing what we're doing, but we have to adapt, and we have to minimize harm to our comrades whenever we can. It does mean that, I can't go into detail, but like some of our actions, our strategies, have to be reevaluated, have to be changed, it goes on. And I think that one implication for us, for folks who are part of movements, right, is this is further confirmation that, you know, we need to be building solidarity with ordinary people. There's a lot of Hong Kongers, as we know, who have been making attempts with mixed results to lobby foreign governments. But to us, right, to us on the Hong Kong left, to us on the transnational kind of abolitionist left, this further shows that we need that transnational movement solidarity, we can't be, there's no winning in terms of colluding with other states. Not only is that going to get you in trouble with this new national security law, that's just not going to actually set you free. We keep us safe, and that's really the takeaway.
Well, you know, the other thing I wanted to ask you is that, you know, if you we look at this law in the context of also, everything that's happening in the U.S., Putin has just been made president for life. Countries like Greece, who are trying to pass or are in the midst of passing new laws against protests and stuff like that. Obviously, in the United States, we've heard months of talking about criminalizing anti-fascism. How do you see this kind of like global ramping up of repression?
Everyone is unhappy with neoliberalism. I don't know anyone who can look at the state of neoliberalism right now. And by that, just because there's a lot of different things that people mean when they say that, by that I mean this unique form of political economy, right, in which the state, through these institutions, international institutions, safeguards capital as much as it can, tries to give a nod to things like liberal democracy while maintaining the control of capital. Everyone agrees that this system is not doing great, that global capitalism, in the way that it's been articulated in the wake of the Cold War, has failed to deliver. The question is what takes its place, right? And so the ruling class is desperate, like you mentioned Putin, you mentioned what's happening in Greece. We're talking about Hong Kong, where we can look at, even what's happening in China, where, if we really look into the economics right now, they've got a lot of debt problems. There's a lot of excess capacity that's come from their initial stimulus that they used to get past the 2008 financial crisis. I mean, there are all these structural problems everywhere that has the ruling class and the state really terrified, no matter where you look. And so it's actually pretty easy to understand why this ramping up of repression is happening. The authoritarianism is desperation. It's that the state has nothing to offer us, right? So it has to use violence to stop us from toppling their structures right this moment. And so you have this battle where you have the failure of let's just say that neoliberalism is kind of occupying the center position, right? And so you have your state actors, your right wingers, trying to position themselves as the savior. And you know, we have to side with the people. We have to reject these right wing fantasies. We have to reject these fictions from the state. We have to reject a return to somehow a better version of neoliberalism, because we know that it can't deliver. We know that it's unsustainable. So what is that other thing? What is the third way? And, you know, I think that's exactly what the Hong Kong left is trying to develop. It's what we're developing with a lot of comrades from, you know, places that are under similar struggles. It's what I think I've heard a lot on your show, too. Right. It's just trying to figure out where we go from here and how we reject these false fantasies.
You know, one of the thing about the new law that we've read is that it further criminalizes things like sabotage as well as strikes by workers, you know, threatens people with up to 10 years in prison for such acts. I don't know if you want to speak on the nuts and bolts of the law and how it would apply to not only people that are in the streets during the current movement, but potentially other struggles as well. It seems like a pretty broad, overarching, you know, anti-resistance law.
Yes. I mean, it's totally, it's completely political. Recently, Hong Kongers held an unofficial primary for the upcoming elections for the Legislative Council within the pro-democracy camp. So people wanted to figure out who their strongest candidates were. So they organized together. They actually created these informal polling stations all across the city. I mean, I'm telling you, this is how seriously Hong Kongers take the idea of democracy. You know, they organized their own kind of election, primary election, and 600,000 people voted, you know, on pretty short notice. And the day after, the chief executive of Hong Kong came out and said that basically, this entire thing, I guess, meaning every one of those 600,000 people, violated the national security law, that this was considered an unacceptable challenge to state authority, which is, you know, one of the things that's been outlawed. Right. And so, I mean, it's such a farce. Just the idea that even just voting in a primary is seen as sedition or trying to you know, be a separatist or some kind of terrorist even, right? Because that's ostensibly what this law is for. When Carrie Lam came out and, you know, introduced it, she said it would apply to only a minuscule, you know, minority of the Hong Kong population, that everyone else had nothing to worry about. Well, 600,000 people were just named as essentially criminals by her. So, I mean, what is this law really about, right? And then, of course, you have stories like what we just published, which is, you know, revealing that the Hong Kong police has actually been directly colluding openly with the U.S. State Department. OK, so is the Hong Kong police going to be prosecuted under this national security law? I mean, that's pretty blatant evidence right there of foreign collusion. That's working with the U.S. government. I mean, so what is this law actually trying to do? And so it's clear to anyone who actually looks at this objectively that this is not about national security. This is about repressing dissent. You mentioned strikes by workers. Well, I mean, Hong Kong has actually, you know, worker strikes in terms of a collective bargaining in Hong Kong, collective bargaining is not even legal. This is something that redo this little part. You mentioned worker strikes. Well, in Hong Kong, collective bargaining isn't even legal. And it was actually the pro-Beijing establishments, including one of the pro-Beijing so-called labor unions, which actually demanded that the right to collectively organize be not included in Hong Kong's post-colonial constitution. And that's precisely, of course, because of its threats to, you know, global capital and the capital interests of the Chinese Communist Party. So, you know, the law is a blank check for the ruling class. But it really just intensifies all the different kinds of repression that have already been happening in Hong Kong.
So the U.S. has denounced the new law. It's interesting, at the same time this is happening, there's a new book that's been put out by neoconservative, longtime political operative and player John Bolton, you know, played a key role in different imperialist ventures, the war in Iraq. He just released a new revealing book on supposedly the tight relationship, or at least some relationship, between the Chinese state and the Trump administration. Trump supposedly asked them for help in his reelection and also praised the construction of concentration camps. I'm just curious if you want to talk about kind of just Trump, because I mean, he's really used, like we've already talked about, as other people have, China as kind of this trope for his base.
Sure. Well, I mean, Trump, like every single U.S. politician, has actually taken both sides of the so-called China issue, right? Trump has praised Xi Jinping. Trump has bashed Xi Jinping. Trump has supported the Hong Kong protests, I guess. He's also denounced them as riots and said that Xi Jinping could take care of them if he wanted. He has, you know, before he was president, praised the Tiananmen massacre, you know, while as president, giving lip service to denouncing Chinese authoritarianism. So, you know, Trump is useful because he reflects the deep hypocrisy at the heart of U.S. foreign policy on China, and actually just the U.S.-China relationship, which is that, again, this kind of confrontation that we get fed again and again in the mainstream narratives and by these politicians' rhetoric is actually not completely representative of the collusion that's happening and in many cases intensifying behind the scenes. And, you know, when you look at the workings of the carceral state as well as the capital states in both the U.S. and China, you find so many similarities. And don't believe for a second that the leaders on both sides aren't learning from each other, aren't discussing these things. I mean, again, these things are documented. So whether it's Trump or it's, you know, John Bolton or it's Steve Bannon, you know, I promise you that all of these people have, you know, taken both sides on these issues at some point. And, you know, even when you look at the rhetoric coming out of, you know, Beijing, who tends to be a little more disciplined than a lot of their American counterparts, right? But even recently, Hua Chunying, who is the spokeswoman for the People's Republic, came out and actually tweeted a long list of U.S. national security laws, including some of the most racist, imperialist laws that have ever been on the books in the U.S., right? This is a long list. And she said, the U.S. has long enjoyed national security legislation. Why can't China enjoy the same? So she was justifying the Hong Kong national security law there. That, to me, spoke volumes about how these leaders actually see each other. That someone like Hua Chunying would look at this record of horrible violence happening in the U.S., a place that the CCP ostensibly opposes, you know, and actually just say we want the same thing. Again, you know, we have to point to these instances whenever they happen, because I think they speak more to the true character of this relationship.
You know, many people have said that one of the reasons that the government in China wants to smash the rebellion in Hong Kong is because they're afraid of it spreading into mainland China, which, of course, for years have seen riots and violent strikes. I mean, there's even a saying like the riot is the collective bargaining unit.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, you know, what are your thoughts on this and in the fear that rebellion in Hong Kong could spread to the rest of China? And, you know, is that a reality? Is the Chinese state actually worried about wide-scale rebellion?
Of course. I mean, this is always their number one fear. I think that if you read between the lines, the Chinese government is more afraid of this than they are of the U.S. government. I think what a lot of the kind of anti-imperialism rhetoric misses is this dynamic that, you know, the CCP is not afraid of being invaded by the U.S. military. They're afraid of being toppled by their own people. And, you know, you see this in terms of the response to the Hong Kong protests. You know, in 2014, kind of the first round of what we see now, the umbrella movements, there were a lot of sympathizers in mainland China. That had authorities in Beijing extremely worried. And over the last 5 years, they've been very diligent in building up a narrative of Hong Kongers as outsiders, as, you know, traitors, as these sort of Western lackeys, right? Which is completely disingenuous because Hong Kongers have always been consistent in asking for the democratic reforms that Beijing itself promised, right? So, but that extends to other things too. I mean, the JASIC struggle, which was when a group of Marxist labor organizers in China tried to infiltrate different factories in China and basically create a new workers' revolution following a lot of Maoist principles, right? When you look at that and see how the CCP responded then, which, you know, was imprisoning the activists, cracking down yet again, just kind of making them disappear by force. You understand that this isn't really about communism here for Beijing. This isn't about workers. This isn't about protecting some kind of revolution. This is about maintaining power. It's really that simple. And whether the challenges are coming from a place of wanting liberal democracy or a place of being, you know, a genuine kind of Marxist Maoist labor movement, or it's coming from, you know, somewhere else, the CCP is going to try to crack down. And one of the lessons that's come out, a lot of these attempts at labor organizing in China, is that while organizers have been able to have limited success at the local level and get maybe a factory kind of like protesting or some people coming out into the streets, they're very atomized. They're not linked up. And this is where the CCP still has an advantage, is that it's able to contain a lot of the unrest in very local areas. And so it's containing the, discontent in Hong Kong. It's containing these labor uprisings in different parts of China. And it's making sure that they don't get articulated as a broader movement. And of course, Chinese nationalism is one of their key tools in ensuring that, in fighting back against this dissent.
I'm sure there are people now with a law being passed, like, you know, wanting to kind of get off the streets maybe and not put themselves in danger. There must be other people that want to continue, but that must be a real gut check for people.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, it's a really sad time. A lot of people are going quiet right now for different reasons. Some people because they're scared, for themselves, for their families. Other people because this is just a moment that they need to take to process. And, you know, I've definitely been among that camp for the last 2 weeks as well. Just trying to figure out, you know, what does this mean for my friends, for everything that I've worked for, as a writer and as an activist and just as someone who cares about this place. In the aftermath of the movement in 2014, Hong Kongers went through 5 years of kind of a just political wandering in the deserts. People were losing a lot of hope, and people really didn't know if we would see another uprising like the umbrella movements again. And of course, we know that the uprising in 2019 has been many, many, many times bigger than what we saw in 2014. But it came after 5 years of a lot of despair. And I was living in Hong Kong during that time, and that was one of the most generative times for me. I did a lot of reading. I did a lot of relationship building. I worked on a lot of different projects, some that had to do with politics, some that didn't. And I don't know. I think that we might be looking at another one of those moments right now where we have to take stock and, you know, kind of maybe retreat a little bit into the shadows. But that doesn't mean we're not going to be building and preparing. And I know that right now, me and my comrades, you know, we're building new relationships. We're, you know, forming these connections that sometimes you don't have the time to really deepen when you're in the midst of a really pitched battle, right? And that's part of the joy of coming on a show like this too, you know, getting to talk to you and getting to share kind of our reflections, kind of not necessarily at the beginning of a struggle, but looking back on the lessons and figuring out what we do here going forward. So, you know, I'm going to be trying to do more of that. And yeah, life goes on.
People that are supporting this movement, this rebellion, what kind of lessons do you think that we should be learning from what's been happening in Hong Kong over the past couple months?
I think the big takeaway is that we need genuine internationalism. We need real transnational solidarity. You know, this is not an empty slogan. This isn't abstract. But we are facing extremely powerful, globally articulated systems of oppression here. And we're dealing with histories that haven't been resolved. We're dealing with struggles that have been defeated in different ways. And we gotta come together and figure this out together. You know, I know that sounds trite. I know that sounds unsatisfying. But to me, there's no way around the idea that we have to get internationalists. And I think that applies to folks who want to see Hong Kong free, and it applies to folks in the U.S. who are coming up against these barriers in their own struggles and activism and saying, okay, where do we go next? And again, knowing that the state is not our friend, that the state is working together against us with the ruling, that the state is working together with the ruling class against us in so many instances in such consistent ways, and that we need this grassroots person-to-person, movement-to-movement kind of solidarity.
So with that in mind, how can people build relationships with people in Hong Kong? What should they be doing right now?
Please follow Lausan. So that's Lausan. We're on Twitter at LausanHK. We have a Facebook page. We've got, you know, a website, lausan.hk. But, you know, we do translations, and, you know, not just from English to Chinese and back, but also to, you know, Indonesian, Tagalog, you know, German, Spanish, French, like Korean. We're really, you know, trying to, make good on this idea of, transnational solidarity. And, keep reading about Hong Kong. You know, don't completely ignore what's being covered in mainstream media. Read it critically. You know, read financial news about what's happening in Hong Kong. And if you can, I mean, like, you know, if it's safe after the pandemic or whatever, you know, go and check it out for yourself. There are a lot of folks who are going to welcome you. A lot of folks on the ground who will be very down to show you what it's like. And the Hong Kong diaspora, the Chinese diaspora community is everywhere. You know, we're all active and doing our work in different ways. And we're a nice bunch. So, seek us out.
Awesome. Well, just again, if you want to tell people where they can follow or support your work.
I mentioned Lausan's, you know, social media at LausanHK, LausanHK on Twitter, and Facebook. And you can read my stuff. You can follow me at Wilfred Chan, WILFREDCHAN. I'm on Twitter as well. I'm also a contributing writer in The Nation. So, yeah, thanks so much.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us. And follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.